It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, a different approach to covering healthcare. No, not the congressional debate or changes in policy, but the stories of local people and their interactions with Pittsburgh's healthcare system. Plus, a visit with Steel City native Jeff Ballou, president of the National Press Club. But first, an eventful last week or so in Harrisburg. Republican-controlled House passed a revenue plan that involves shuffling funds from other accounts. The state missed some payments, totaling more than $1.7 billion. Pennsylvania's credit rating was downgraded. The Senate then rejected the Republican House plan. All that, but still no complete budget. What does this all mean to the state, to taxpayers, and to recipients of state dollars? We're going to find out from Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back, Natasha. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And joining us from Harrisburg is Brad Bumstead, bureau chief for the Caucus, the weekly newspaper covering state government and politics. Welcome back, Brad.
Thank you so much.
Your comments and questions are always welcome. Please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Earlier this week, Governor Wolf said the state will meet its payments and no cuts or delays in state services if lawmakers reach an agreement on how to fund the $32 billion budget by October 1st, 1 week from this Sunday. Doesn't seem like there's even agreement over the need for quick action. We'll start with you, Natasha, and then please, Brett.
Yeah, so there's definitely the Governor Wolf is really trying to communicate a sense of urgency to try to get something done. However, by all signs, I had a chance to be in Harrisburg a few days this week, and the Senate did take some action to reject a House plan. There doesn't seem to be anywhere near close to striking a final deal at this point. As people have told me on both sides, there's still a lot of moving parts. There's not just one final thing they're trying to hammer out, but ranging from how to expand the state's gambling to whether or not to budge on any of the tax increases Wolf wants to see. There's a lot still that needs to be worked out. And despite things like a credit downgrade this week and other things going on that are really concerning some about the state's fiscal status, we're still no end in sight at this point, as far as I can tell.
Brad, you're there all the time. Any sense of urgency or not?
No, not at all. I think it would take a monumental downgrade of Pennsylvania bonds to junk bond status before people really reacted to that. And even then, they might not so quickly. Look, what this is all about is the T word, taxes, that are contained in the Senate bill but are not in the House bill. They put this revenue bill together, House Republicans did, using spare funds and excess monies that from previous years, which is quite another story about how that could be. And, you know, some somewhat illusory revenue that would come in from gaming, which nobody has figured out how to do yet. But no taxes like those that are in the Senate revenue plan, where there's utility taxes and a tax on Marcellus Shale. There's a significant share of the House Republican caucus that doesn't want to do a tax increase under any circumstances. Republicans control the House by a big margin. There might be enough southeastern Pennsylvania lawmakers who, if a Marcellus Shale extraction tax can get to the floor, that they would support it. But other than that, it's not going to move through normal channels.
So let's get a sense of just how not urgent this is. We talked with House Republican spokesman Steve Miskin.
Spending money right now is not going to put us into a deficit. We are not in a deficit. This budget is funded probably without doing anything until April, May.
Well, with that kind of statement, are we going to be going on this until April or May, Natasha?
I don't think it's going to take out that long. And I do think it's important to note that we're not quite in the same situation we were in the likes of 2015, when there was a straight out impasse, no budget was in place. And in that during those months, there really were dire consequences directly impacting the people of Pennsylvania. Preschools were closing down. Domestic violence shelters were turning away women. We're not under those kinds of circumstances. We've talked, fellow education reporters have fanned out, and a lot of local school officials aren't too concerned about missing this next set of payments. However, if it does go on another month or two or three, that could be further cause for concern.
Brad, could you see it going on another month or more?
Yes, I could. But the thing, Mishkin is correct in this, and that is that the state does have about $30 billion of revenue that will come in. Some months are slower than others in terms of revenue, but, you know, it's a $32 billion budget that was passed. There is apparently at least $30 billion worth of revenue, so there is funding to keep the state running for a long time. At some point, they come up short of it's actually $2.2 billion more that's needed to fund the budget that people in the House voted for as well, and now, you know, have are involved in this dispute over how to fund it.
So let's get to how to fund that $2.2 billion and the crux of the disagreement between the House and the Senate. Senate Republican leaders and Governor Wolf maintain they're uncomfortable with any budget that doesn't have recurring revenue, and the House GOP plan, Brad, was really a shuffling of funds, correct?
Yeah.
So what is being negotiated?
Recurring revenue.
Right. So what is being negotiated?
One of the things the House did this year that is also causing, you know, a lot of discussion about maybe this happening more every year is the so-called Gang of 18 in the House by Representative Mal puts they fanned out and surveyed and found what they say amounted to as much as $1.2 billion in unspent funds and reserves that they think, you know, that they might be able to use to plug some of this deficit. They said they could use about half of that, about $620 million. Even the Senate, who's skeptical of some of their plans to use that funding, agreed there's probably about $140, $150 million that could be used. Now, the concern, as you just mentioned, is that would be a one-time pull of that funding. You know, it might leave us in the same situation next year. What I've heard from House leadership is, yeah, you know, this is an extraordinary one-time grab, but we're trying to solve an extraordinary spending problem, and they want to see, you know, further deeper cuts perhaps next year. But there's still a lot of uncertainty over where this money's coming from and, you know, just how much of it could be used and what should be done really to get the states in, you know, resolving a structural deficit and not just gimmicks happening every year to just get by.
So, Brad, go ahead, Brad.
Well, I was going to say it's incredible that 2 months after the budget is passed, we find out there's potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in other excess funds that could be used. The Senate says $150 million, maybe it's $400 million. Who knows whether it's a billion, like the House Republicans say. But whatever, you would think that the very first thing you would do during a new budget season when you hold appropriation hearings right off the bat is find out how much is available in excess funds and how much of that can be used before you start the budget. I mean, you know, it's just they're not surpluses that are there to protect certain funds. In some cases, they're just excess funds. In one case, I was told it was a 10-year-old fund. I mean, some of it's obligated. It's true. But the point that confuses me, it's just not clear if certain monies out of that are obligated, where are they in the actual budget? You know, I don't see the connection. Why all these funds? It was actually $12 billion in special funds and excess funds that the House Republicans identified. $12 billion with a B.
Does that sort of grate on Republicans? You're sort of sitting on money that was, let's face it, generated from tax dollars originally?
Well, of course, especially when they're being asked to approve a tax increase. I mean, would you? I mean, would you at least want to see what you can pare down out of that first before you talk about how much of a tax increase you're going to pass or how much you're going to borrow? That's another significant part of both of these plans and sort of different fashions they're talking about borrowing money. So borrowing money to pay off a deficit.
And as I heard Charlie Giroux, CEO of Quantum Communications, public affairs firm in Harrisburg, put it the other day, you know, using this money would be using taxpayer money to solve taxpayer problems without dipping deeper into taxpayer pockets. So some people see that, you know, and hey, why not use some of this money to do that?
We're talking about the still incomplete Pennsylvania budget with Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Brad Bumstead, bureau chief for the Caucus, the weekly newspaper covering state politics and government. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. So that takes us to spending freezes. Are these an empty threat? Could there be really more spending freezes, additional actions or inactions from the Wolf administration, since it doesn't look like there'll be any agreement by that October 1st time frame that the governor was outlining? Brad, you first, please.
Yes, there could be. In fact, at some point, there would have to be. I mean, Governor Wolf would have to balance the budget. There's a lawsuit pending right now against the governor and the legislature for not having a balanced budget in place. But yes, and it's happened before in other years. Governor Rendell, you know, toward the end of a calendar year or early into a new calendar year, would make certain cuts to balance the budget based on the insufficient revenue. And the governor can do that unilaterally, doesn't need legislative approval. There's some theory that politically, at least, Governor Wolf is running for re-election, that some Republicans would like to see him have to make cuts that would affect his re-election campaign, since, you know, you couldn't just make it all funds that are favorable to Republicans. You'd probably have to cut education to get into $2 billion worth of money.
And I think it's important to note, too, you know, in Pennsylvania, we've been going through this budget gridlock for a couple of years now, when we have a Democrat governor and a GOP-controlled legislature. And it's been pointed out by groups that Pennsylvania has virtually no consequences when lawmakers fail to pass a budget on time compared to other states who do it differently. So I know this is raising more questions. I know a lot of just the average voter is probably just frustrated. Why can't they get it done? Why can't they do their job? Why do they go on summer break when this wasn't done? And as Brad said, why wasn't you know, why weren't some of these funds identified months ago? Why are we looking at it months after the budget deadline? In Ohio, all facets of government shut down if the legislature ends its session without at least agreeing to an interim budget by deadline. In Virginia, the governor presents a budget proposal in December, and the part-time legislature cannot adjourn until it agrees to a budget, which typically gets enacted by the end of February. California prohibits lawmakers from drawing travel or living expenses until a budget gets enacted. And in more than 20 states, late budgets trigger almost complete government shutdowns. You know, that's when employees are out of work. Everything's happening where, there'll be a lot more visible pressure on lawmakers to act.
I believe, Brad, under Governor Rendell, there was shutdowns and all that, but the courts basically forced them not to. Is that correct? Is my memory correct?
Right. Governor Rendell tried to do that. Everybody knew that was a non-starter because the courts had ruled previously, going back to the 70s and 80s, that you can't lay off state employees. That if they are working, they have to be paid. And a series of court decisions have held that not only do state employees have to be paid, but people who get welfare benefits have to still receive them. And there just are not any, you know, avenues anymore that can force the legislature and the governor to make an agreement like there used to be. So also, the legislature used to have so-called walking around money that legislative leaders and governors would use to obtain the votes they need to get something through at a time like this. And those don't exist anymore.
All right, so what have we learned might be on the table in any next round of delayed payments and freezes, human service providers, grants? What have we learned? What do we know?
Well, they already did delay at least one set of payments related specifically to the likes of Medicaid and pension payments for school districts, as well as, you know, and there's a lot of groups that benefit from Medicaid, including managed care providers. So those are some of the groups that have already been affected.
Brad, what are you hearing might be on the table for future freezes?
I don't know anything beyond what she just said in terms of what speculation about what could be frozen. But look, just that more significant education funds might have to be cut. That's all, as I stated before, because you can't get into $2 billion worth of cuts and not get into some serious programs.
And I would point out, for some school districts, this might not be a problem. A lot of school districts have a lot of reserves. They even have a pension, a special pension spike fund, or they're, you know, have a lot of money coming in. But for districts that are really small, that are barely already able to pay their bills on time due to their own financial challenges and low tax bases, those are the ones where taking out these loans can really hurt them. You know, there are some counties who are still paying back the interest from loans they took out 2 years ago. So the ones that are the smallest local government agencies will be hurt the most if that does happen.
So this week, Standard & Poor's downgraded Pennsylvania's credit rating from AA- to A+. I believe that's the sixth straight downgrade since 2012. So really, what does this downgrade mean to people who are not necessarily in the financial industry? In other words, to our listeners, to taxpayers, what's it mean briefly?
I'll let Brad get into that one a little bit more because, as he said, I think he noted until there's a junk bond status, people might not really pay as much attention. But just for a little context there, I think it's worth noting that as it stands, only Illinois and New Jersey have lower Standard & Poor's ratings than Pennsylvania. And this week's downgrade marked our sixth downgrade or negative credit watch since 2012. So this has been an ongoing problem.
Right. And it's not clear how much it would be at this point, but generally, that trend, if it continues going down, means that taxpayers will pay more to borrow money, Pennsylvania, when the state issues general obligation bonds. So, you know, the paying off the interest will require higher interest rates because we'll be more of a risk.
We have less than 2 minutes left. I want to get you this. You know, it used to be that the lower chamber, the House, would sort of cave in a bit to the upper chamber, the Senate. Is that the case anymore? In other words, or is there going to be some hard lines drawn between the House and Senate? Brad, let's start with you.
In the past couple of years, I've seen more institutional rivalry between the Senate and the House than there is sometimes partisanship, you know, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. There is a real friction, let's say, between, even though they're both Republican-controlled chambers, that the Senate wants this, the Senate did that, the House, you know, wants us to do such and such, and there's a real acrimonious sometimes feeling, at least between House and Senate Republicans who are running the legislature.
And as just one example of that, for instance, they both agree about, you know, $200, $225 million worth of revenue we can maybe get through expanding gambling. They can't decide on how to do it, and they have very different ways of wanting to go about doing that. The House really wants to see these up to 40,000 gaming devices be allowed in the likes of, you know, bars and taverns, and including, you know, ones they say that are, you know, thousands are out there already illegally operating right now they could be making money from. The Senate is very much opposed to that idea. They prefer iGaming, you know, legalizing online gaming, as well as expanding existing casinos.
Natasha Lindstrom is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Brad Bumstead is the bureau chief for The Caucus, the weekly newspaper covering state government and politics. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Congress is facing an end-of-the-month deadline to eliminate and replace Obamacare. We're going to discuss the real stories behind health care next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Mayor Bill Peduto says a full-time team is working on the city's proposal for Amazon's new headquarters. He says the city is working to raise $500,000 to entice the internet retail giant, which has pledged 50,000 jobs. And Pittsburgh is among the top routes being considered by Hyperloop One, in which people would travel through tubes via magnetic levitation. If built, Pittsburghers could travel to Columbus in just 18 minutes. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Republican-controlled Senate intends to vote on the Graham-Cassidy plan, the latest in a series of GOP proposals to repeal and replace Obamacare, by September 30th. That's the deadline to use budget rules, which allow them to pass a plan with only Republican votes. Now, supporters say it will ease the sharply rising cost of health insurance. Detractors, including Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey, who was in Pittsburgh yesterday, say millions will lose coverage.
But the more important adverse consequence is what this will do to people. This will hurt a lot of people. in our state. When people lose Medicaid coverage, kids with disabilities, seniors trying to get into nursing homes, children, this is devastating. There's only one response. Stop it. Kill the snake in the grass.
Now, much of the national debate and rhetoric over healthcare legislation has been about numbers, but the journalists at Public Source want to keep it local. They're asking for names, voices, and stories of Pittsburghers experiencing the healthcare system firsthand. Joining us now in studio is Hallie Stockton. She's the managing editor at Public Source. Good to see you again, Hallie.
You too, Kevin.
Now, you're invited to join the conversation. Please tweet us your questions, comments, and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Hallie, I mentioned the debate surrounding the legislative attempts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. When you and your reporters sort of were kicking around the topic of health care, what questions arose in your newsroom that led to this project we're talking about?
Well, you know, we always think about how these broader policies affect people locally, and our mission is to elevate voices in our community. And so we think about those people with pre-existing conditions, small businesses, people with disabilities, and in general, health equity for women, the LGBTQ plus community. And we're thinking, you know, we don't want to create the narrative here. We want to have people come to us and help us build this project. And not only do we want to hear individual stories, but we also, and we're not discounting that because we certainly need to hear that. And we need to hear that on a very personal and intimate level so that we can, one, ascertain, you know, if people are finding the ideal care that they need, what ideas they have. But also, we want to hear from doctors, nurses, and researchers, which Pittsburgh is rich with right. those folks. So right. We want to hear from them about, you know, what works. How do they keep themselves out of the healthcare system, essentially?
Right. So were there any stories, either locally or nationally, something that happened that made you decide this was worth Public Source's energy commitment?
Well, the healthcare of our people is always going to be worth our energy and commitment. I wouldn't say that there was any one specific thing. There's always a slow burn of important health stories out there. And with just the ecosystem of Pittsburgh involving so many people of different backgrounds, but also our insurers, the business side, Allegheny Health Network, UPMC, there's a you know, specific narrative surrounding those companies here. And we want to get past kind of those generalizations about those groups.
Does your reporting, does this project begin from the understanding that the existing healthcare system is broken, but for the person who can't pay the bills, can't access care or a necessary procedure, the system might be broken for that individual?
It has to go to that individual brokenness, I guess. You know, there are a lot of people who have stories about how the healthcare system has not worked for them, whether it's from billing to a botched procedure. And that's why we have the focus to go beyond what's broken here. You know, we're not going to say that everything is broken, but we need people to come to us and tell us what's not broken, because everything that you hear is that it is, you know, highly ineffective, and also for some groups, specific vulnerable populations, dangerous for them in some cases, or they're avoiding it because they feel they have that perception that it's not suited to them. So that's why we want to take that step farther to see what's the innovative ideas that are out there, what are the solutions, and kind of how might the average person more effectively approach and use that system.
You have a short form on your website for folks to fill out about their experiences so that you and your reporters can explore, investigate these stories. What are you expecting? Accounts of personal experiences about getting difficulty in accessing care, the cost of it, waiting lines? What are you looking for?
Yeah, we certainly do expect to hear from, and we hope to hear from patients out there, you and your loved ones, what you've seen from you know, a family member going through the system. We expect to hear that, you know, there are certain illnesses where they had a difficult time finding the right doctor. Or yes, waiting times where, you know, and how that may. How that affected their care. But we, you know, we also, we're already hearing from people. We just released this form on Tuesday. Right. We're already hearing from people, and those are, it's a mix of physicians as well, and a mix of ideas that touch on generally mental health issues, and also down to a specific billing issue that involves local government and a specific provider. So we're, you know, we're completely open. We're casting the net wide on purpose here. And in fact, at the form, which you can find at publicsource.org/healthform, we kept it very simple for people to fill in. We're only asking for name, best way to contact, and leaving a blank form for you to fill out with your idea, your story, and that's it. And then when you share that, you're sharing that only with the Public Source newsroom, and we don't use any of that publicly without your permission. But we are committing to review all of these stories and follow up with people.
So we have just a minute left, Hallie, and I wanted to ask you this. Something you could get, could it turn into what your website is probably best known for, investigations such as, you know, misuse, underuse, whatever, of resources?
Absolutely. The spirit of Public Source is to go from that personal story all the way to investigative when appropriate. And when we find those important nuggets and follow it through, that's certainly the possibility and the goal to have that local impact.
And remind us one more time how people can fill out this form.
Please visit publicsource.org/healthform.
And when can we expect to start seeing those stories in this project?
It's an ongoing project, so we're already following up on tips. We don't have a specific date yet, but be ready.
Hallie Stockton is the managing editor for Public Source. Hallie, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up, a visit with the president of the National Press Club, Jeff Ballew. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the University of Pittsburgh breaks ground on the Cathedral of Learning in 1926. The 42-story Gothic Revival building is the tallest educational facility in the Western Hemisphere and contains 2,000 rooms. In its history, it's been used to house military personnel and has served as the backdrop for a dozen films and books. And Lego is considering making a model of the building. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 22nd, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans.
Huge crowds have been gathering really all across the globe today for women's marches.
One woman was holding a sign that just said, "I'm afraid."
With this order, President Trump is exercising his rightful authority to keep our people safe.
You can dress it up and call it anything you want. It's a Muslim ban.
There has been an increase in reports of attacks based on race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation since Donald Trump was elected president.
After the administration's announcement that it's going to end DACA, there were widespread protests around the country yesterday.
Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch.
President Trump has ordered the Defense Department to unwind an earlier move by the Obama administration that allowed transgender people to serve openly in uniform.
Violence erupted yesterday after white nationalist groups descended on the city of Charlottesville.
I support everyone saying what they want to say, but when it becomes violent, nobody belongs here, and I don't care what your position is.
It has been an eventful first 8 months for President Trump's administration and therefore for the media covering those happenings and their impact nationally as well as locally. We're pleased to be joined on the phone from Washington by Jeff Ballou. Jeff is the president of the National Press Club and a news editor with Al Jazeera Media Network. He's the first African-American and first Pittsburgher to hold the post of president. Jeff returns to his hometown tomorrow to speak on freeing the press, why journalism matters at the Engineers Society building in downtown Pittsburgh. Welcome, Jeff. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for the invitation.
And with us in studio, our local press leaders. Kim Palmero is the president of the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania. Welcome, Kim. Good to have you here.
Thank you for allowing us to be here.
And Akemi Harrison is executive producer for WPXI Television and an active member of the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation. Welcome, Akemi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. I'd like to start with a brief assessment from each of you of these last 8 months, whether the developments and how it's affected you in your professional life. Let's start with you, Jeff.
Wow.
nothing like a broad question.
It's been an interesting ride. The whole fisticuffs between the administration and those supporting the president pretty much started almost literally from my first day in office, January 13th. And it abated somewhat, but the die has been cast pretty much. What we've learned, though, is that the President of the United States is tactical about this. Some people try to assail the president on a number of fronts, but it has been as disappointing as, and that's a nice way of putting it, as the president's attacks on the press have been, we also have noticed that they are tactical because in this sense. He would, by day, trash one or more news organizations or colleagues, and then turn right around and call up Maggie Haberman of the New York Times and dish like it's, like they're like a gossip columnist on, hey, it's not really not me, but it's an attention getting tactic. But what is lost in that are a number of things that we've discovered over the past 8 or 9 months.
Okay.
What's lost is a true sense of transparency on the presidency. What's lost is a sense of that colleagues around the world depend on the symbolism of the United States being a beacon of free press and the United States government in doing its part in upholding and protecting the Constitution and by extension, of course, the First Amendment, et cetera. But when they see the leader of the free world trashing the Fourth Estate, not just domestically, but on the world stage, that gives a green light to rogue actors around the world to just go after journalists and not just in a verbal fashion, but persecute journalists.
Right. I want to get in.
And that was bad enough. You had, domestically, you had all kinds of incidents up to and including the body slamming of a Guardian reporter by a now sitting member of Congress who gets that sort of, if the president is down with this, I can do this too.
I want to get into some of those attacks on journalists in a little bit. I want to get the local reactions from Kim and Akemi. Let's start with you, Akemi.
Yeah, so I'll say locally, I can sum up the last 8 months as just tiresome. Like we were fatigued. It's like every single day there was something else.
And not exciting, challenging.
Well, very, all of that. But because you have to be so on, because you're so surprised with some of the things that are like coming out of the White House. And then when he screams like fake news, and then you get emails into the newsroom from people who are calling you fake news, or you addressed President Trump as Mr. Trump on the second reference and you're fake news. And to me, that's very so that's why I would say it's been fatiguing, because then you have to decide, well, should we, like, what should we cover? There's been so much. Like, how do we organize this since I work in a TV news medium? You know, like, right. We have to figure out, like, what's important. So so that, and then as far as locally, the attacks have been from the viewers. We've had really racist emails calling anchors of color out of, you know, racial slurs. And we've had just because of based on something maybe, say, like, President Trump has done. So it's been what I would describe as very fatiguing.
Kim?
Yeah, I can just speak in general. As Akemi and Jeff have noted, there's just an awful lot of anger right now. And it is very difficult when you are a journalist and, you know, you are a witness to history and you are trying to hold institutions accountable. Journalists are biased in favor of facts. I mean, journalists want to report and to hold accountable. And, you know, there is a lot of anger, I think, from readers and confusion right now. There are not as many local papers for people to kind of fall back on. This is my local newspaper. On the good side, there are many more places to read news. But I think all of this together has created a sense of people maybe aren't necessarily sure what to read and how often to read it to get their news of the day. And sometimes, you know, maybe fall back on things that aren't quite reliable, maybe things that sort of reinforce an opinion they already have. And I think for readers, I would hope that citizens consider their responsibility just simply to be well informed and to seek out good sources of news.
I want to ask you all quickly, have all these events over these first 8 months, from attempted restrictions on immigration to women's marches to reports of increased attacks on minorities to Charlottesville, has it changed your approach and coverage, or maybe how they have influenced media coverage? Jeff from the national, and then Kim and Kemi from the local. Jeff?
I think from the national perspective and international perspective, I think we just have to be, and this point has been made somewhat already, we have to be doubly sure that we have to be beyond reproach in terms of our accuracy. We have to offer perspective, because what my colleagues have been describing in some respects is has been a lack of understanding of basic civics in terms of how the you know, checks and balances work in our government, and what free speech is and what it is not, and what are its limits when it comes to, you know, marches in Charlottesville and things of that nature. You find that the Twitter traffic is, with all this greed, is a sense of, in our approach is, we can't just chase everything like a dog whistle. We have to sort of take a step back and say, okay, what's happening here? Put things into perspective, help people understand what's going on, and not get caught up in the emotional and cyclical aspect of what the president and his allies have tried to inject into the national and global dialogue. So that, it's for us, that's changed the sense of being extra careful, triple checking facts, and making sure that when we're on the receiving end of the attacks, and when these volatile events are happening, that we provide a sense of clarity instead of adding to the confusion.
Yeah, Jeff just used triple-checking facts. In a sense, those attacks on the media, is that sort of a good thing for us, because it forces us to double and triple-check facts to make sure our products, our stories are absolutely right, the best we can possibly get them? Akemi, then Kim.
Yeah, so I think that while you're right, we do need to do our due diligence, I do think, too, it allows our consumers, so we have consumers on our digital platforms, TV platforms, you know, everyone is in all these spaces. It allows them to really question everything, but also not trust us. So I think while it's good for us to, it's really good for us to do our homework, and it's good for us to be like, we know exactly like what we're presenting to you. It's also kind of disheartening when no one trusts you. So you have to make sure that you're like, I've proved to you this, and they still question it.
Okay.
Yeah, I would back up what Jeff and Akemi said as well. I think as journalists, we have to, you know, it falls to us to provide perspective, accuracy, clarity. And how do we do that? The simple answer is we do whatever it takes.
Right.
Failure is not an option. This is too important. What we do is important. Who guards the guardians? Somebody has to.
Akemi alluded to this, Jeff. The title of your talk tomorrow, Freeing the Press, Why Journalism Matters. Is it a matter of course that journalists will always have to explain to defend why journalism matters, Jeff?
Well, no, it's not for, I mean, it's for journalists just to do their jobs. And it's for people like me who are the standard bearers for the profession to explain and remind, and not only just our colleagues, but to the general public to say, look, you know, I'm finding myself in the role of civics teacher these past 9 months in many respects. There are a lot of people that come from a very, you know, not well thought through place, or in some cases a very dark place. And some people are just plain scared because they see, you know, the economic changes in front of them. They don't necessarily know how to respond, and they're grasping for, you know, sort of very lowest common denominator opinions on things. And it's up to us, it's up to people like me to remind folks, it's like, we're here to help you be better, to be the best citizens you can be, and be armed with the best information you should have in a democracy. And when the institutions that you're supposed, that you're voting for, that you're paying taxes to, are undermining the valuable institutions that we're supposed to trust, then we have a responsibility to remind those taxpayers, those voters, that this is your government. This is what they're doing. This is what they're not doing. And you have, and it's your responsibility to plug in and change it and not blast the messenger, because what we're doing is simply taking what they're saying and corroborating it with the facts. And if we don't do that, then we're all going to be lost in this sort of downward spiral of uncivil conversation and fact-free dialogue. And that's a recipe for chaos.
Yeah. Or Kenny, you wanted to comment?
Oh, well, no, honestly, he pretty much hit the nail on the head. It's like, you know, it's kind of going back to the point of we have a job to do. And like Kim was saying, like we have this is our job. This is the reason why we love journalism, is because we want to display like, here's what's going on. We have the, you know, free press for a reason. We're letting you know what's going on. I think the thing, again, that going back to like what's disheartening, is that most people still even question, like they don't even understand to trust. They don't know the difference between the credible journalism outlets and the credible journalist to say some random article on Facebook that truly is fake news. So yeah, I mean, to do our jobs, it's definitely, we have that fire in us to continue to do that job. And we have to work twice as hard, as Jeff mentioned, if not three or four times as hard, to prove that this is what, this is why you should really believe in the work that we've done.
The Pittsburgh Black Media Federation and, of course, the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania are hosting Jeff's speech tomorrow at the Engineers Club. So, Kim, as president of the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania, why did you want to bring Jeff in?
Well, I was fortunate enough to attend his inauguration in January with Stacey Federhoff of the Women's Press Club, and we thought it was important to support Jeff. He's from Pittsburgh. He's a dynamic journalist, and, you know, as our discussion points out today, there's a lot of discussion about how important journalism is, and we thought it was crucial to bring him here for him to spread his message and to bring that to Pittsburgh. So we are deeply appreciative of him and the work he's done and the example he's setting.
And this sort of points out the collaboration among newsrooms, because Jeff, you'll be talking to a bunch of journalists tomorrow.
Indeed, and you know, frankly, I'm still humbled and honored by the invitation. There's no sort of greater honor than when your hometown says, "Hey, come and rally the troops." And that's what that's where I see myself. And the fact that you know that a kid from Homewood could go through the Pittsburgh public school systems, graduate from Taylor Ardise, go to Penn State, go be a part of the En-ROADS program, to have an internship at KDK during college, and be blessed with all the opportunities, and be able to bring that back, all that back home, is sort of, for me, it's a thank you to say to my colleagues what my block in Homewood gave me, and what my mentors gave me along the way, and teachers and everybody else invested me with all of these values, that I could in turn be a journalist, and not only be a journalist, but represent the profession. And so I owe it to my colleagues back home to say, and family and friends, to say, hey, this is a big thank you. And while I'm thanking you, let's remind ourselves of just how powerful we are as citizens, and just how much responsibility we have as journalists. And that's ultimately, you know, what I'm going to be saying tomorrow. It's kind of part love letter to Pittsburgh, part let's not forget who we are, and you know, to sort of invoke the line from Hill Street Blues, which of course is a product of the drama department of CMU, you know, let's be careful out there. That's what I'm doing, essentially, and celebrating. I celebrated Pittsburgh during my inauguration in a very fervent way, and I was deeply grateful for Stacey and Kim and the others that came down, where you had 308 terrible towels being flung in the air during my speech.
It was great.
But you know, I'm not delivering that kind of a speech tomorrow. Just a warning.
Okay.
I am going to try to just say, you know, reinforce everything that was given to me. You know, with great power comes great responsibility. And when you represent 3,000 members of the National Press Club worldwide, and you're the face of the Fourth Estate just two blocks from the White House, you have a responsibility to go to Akron and LA and other places I've traveled over these past 9 months, and to rally the troops and be asked point blank things, questions like, is this a permanent state to be under assault? Or is this going to be a golden age of journalism? What is it going to be? And we're seeing hopeful signs of great journalism on horrible things that are happening and great things that are happening, from driverless cars to the opioid crisis. I mean, there are a lot of things that we have to cover, but we have to make sure we have to keep our heads on straight and make sure the people, our readers, our viewers, our listeners, understand our role and appreciate our role, and recognize that, you know, we're not in this business to be popular. We're in this business to inform.
All right. Very briefly, we have just about 30 seconds left. I'm going to get from Kim and Akemi. What one key issue item will you be following to see how it affects the Pittsburgh region as we go forward?
You want to take it, Kim? I've always been going first, so I'm trying to be courteous.
I think that what I would hope is that readers just follow the news to be informed on many topics, not just
okay.
Yeah, I would back that up just to say I'd like to see more trust established, reestablished with our you know, local news outlets and platforms, and I would say that that's going to be our goal, and that's honestly it's something we're putting forth right now.
All right, Jeff Ballou, president of the National Press Club, is an editor with Al Jazeera. Jeff returns to his hometown tomorrow to speak at the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania. Kim Palmero is the president of the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania. And Akemi Harrison is the executive producer for WPXI Television and a member of the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the invitation, Kevin.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistance from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.